Okay. Before my enlightenment months, while I was still a bodhisattva. Interesting, he doesn't have an unenlightened bodhisattva. Yeah, which the text says. So this is a classic standard phrase in the Pali, Pubeva. Before my enlightenment, Anabhisambuddhasa, when I was an unenlightened bodhisattva, then this occurred to me. What is the gratification in the world? The asada. What is the danger and what is the escape? And this word asada we met yesterday in the Vinaya class as a description, or as a gloss on the idea of sata, or satiety is to take pleasure in something. So asada, the gratification, the sweet taste of the world. Adinava, the danger, the threat, the drawbacks, and the nisarana is the escape. So obviously this one wouldn't be allowed into the US prisons. And actually the word nisarana is from the word we all know, sarana, the three refuges, and then nisarana means without, literally without refuge. Okay? But here obviously sort of switching the meaning around is not like a refuge but like a cage or getting out of the cage. Okay. Then it occurred to me, whatever pleasure and joy there is in the world, this is the gratification in the world. Okay? Yang ko lokang paticca upadyati. Whatever sukha is, and somanasa that arises in dependence on the world, then that is the gratification in the world, or relation to the world. Sukha and somanasa too, which is words for pleasant feeling, but somanasa is literally from the root manas, meaning mind, and so somanasa literally means good mindness. Okay, so it always refers to a pleasant mental feeling, whereas sukha is much more broad. It can be a mental or a physical feeling, and it might not even be a feeling at all. But where sukha and somanasa come together and where they're defined, then they're often defined as somanasa is pleasant mental feeling and sukha is pleasant bodily feeling. But that's not necessarily the case here, but when they are defined, for example, in the Satipatthana Sutta, not Satipatthana Sutta, but in similar contexts, that's how they're defined. Okay, so the gratification, pleasure. And what is the danger in the world? The adinava is the world is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. Viparinama dhamma, or of the nature to change. And what is the escape in the world regarding the world is the vinaya. Okay, vinaya here meaning the dispelling, driving away of chandaraga, desire and lust. Attachment to the world, the abandoning of desire and lust for the world. So here vinaya and pahana, abandoning, have the same meaning. Okay. And then the Buddha went on, so long, monk says, I did not directly know as they really are. The gratification in the world is gratification, it's danger, and the escape as escape. For so long I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world, with its devas, its mara and brahma, in this population, with its ascetics and brahmins, its devas and humans. But when I directly all knew this, then I claimed to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world. The knowledge and vision arose in me, unshakable is the liberation of my mind. This is my last birth, now there is no renewed existence. So, you see, in this way, because it starts up before my awakening, so it's talking about like one aspect or one direction of looking at the bodhisattva's contemplation process that led to enlightenment. And so we find similar phrases. For example, this is obviously reminds us of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha's first sermon, And similar kinds of phrasing are found throughout the suttas in different contexts whenever the Buddha is talking about a way of contemplation. So that's one of the things that reminds us not to take these things sort of too literally. There's not like one particular kind of avenue that the Buddha took to realize awakening. So that, like, this particular presentation is not something different from, say, the Four Noble Truths or dependent origination, but they're just different ways of describing the experience. So how do the gratification, the danger and the escape, how do they fit into the Four Noble Truths?
Knowing the danger is understanding the second noble truth.
Is it?
Okay, there's a cause of suffering. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've covered that line in that particular instance. But there is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The cause of suffering. The way to end the suffering.
Yeah.
And then the third gate for path being that. Mm-hmm. The escape gate for path being the fourth noble truth.
Mm-hmm.
The escape of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Gratification. That's suffering itself.
Mm-hmm.
What was the other one?
Danger.
The danger.
Yeah.
I think that would be the first noble truth.
Yeah.
That there is suffering.
Yeah. What about the gratification?
That's what? The gratification.
Is that, does that come under the which noble truth is that?
The attachment?
It doesn't say attachment there, does it? It says the pleasure and bliss. Of the world.
Is that denying that there is pleasure in bliss?
Yeah.
So what is that?
No, but it's number two.
Sukha is also dukkha. That's also first noble truth, yeah?
It's saying number two.
What?
It's the cause of suffering.
Doesn't say anything about craving there.
Does it have to?
Well, I would hope so. I think that's the cause of suffering.
Any feeling is suffering.
Yeah. So that would put it under the first noble truth.
Well, the first noble truth is to say that there is suffering. That's necessarily to say that there is.
Yeah.
It's the cause of suffering.
Well, by saying that the
is the cause of suffering. What may cause of suffering?
Dependent origination. Yeah. Any other opinions? Any other thoughts? Sorry? Okay, so the asada is under the first noble truth. Is that, do we have a vote on that? See, this is how the Abhidhamma got written.
What do you think?
What do I think? Well, the second one obviously is the first noble truth, so the impermanence and suffering of the world. Yeah, so it's obviously the first noble truth of suffering. And I would say that the first part is just the flip side of that is also part of the first noble truth. It's just the dualism of the world, just like the state that we're put into. And although, as I say, it's closely related to the second noble truth, so our craving and attachment tends to be stimulated by the sweet taste of the world. And the abandoning the nisarana of the world, really, more technically, is actually the third noble truth, is the nibbana, is the escape. Okay, so always the abandoning of desire and so on is always nibbana, is the third noble truth. But of course it depends on the escape route. Yeah, so this word nisarana here really refers to the state of being escaped rather than the route to the escape, but the route to the escape obviously is the Eightfold Path, is the fourth noble truth.
Okay,
Not that explicitly, no.
So what's the dhamma when the dhamma?
Sorry?
This bit of sentence
was idang loke nisaranam. Yeah, this regarding the world, or this in the world, is the escape. Literally. One of the things that this whole phrasing sort of pivots around is this locative case for loke, which literally means in the world, but more idiomatically it means regarding the world, or with reference to the world, and in that sense it can also kind of almost be extended to mean from the world.
Of the world?
Not really of the world, no.
Right.
No. It's locative. Can mean for the world, so the desire and lust for the world.
Isn't that desire and lust for the world second noble truth?
The desire and lust for the world is the second noble truth, yeah. But abandoning that is then the third noble truth.
Yeah. In fact, so you've got two rolled into one.
Yeah.
The removal and abandoning of desire and lust for the world.
Okay. Okay, and then this one here follows on from that. And this is quite interesting one. If once there was no gratification in the world, asado, then the beings would not be enamored with the world. Sarajayum, Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated enamored. But because there is gratification in the world, beings become enamored with it. Okay? So notice Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation there, gratification in the world, is sort of he's trying to work around this locative case, which has sort of different implications in different contexts. If there was no escape, if there was no gratification in the world, there was no gratification regarding the world. Perhaps. But because there is gratification in the world, beings become enamored. If there was no danger in the world, then beings would not become nibbida, disenchanted, disgusted, pissed off, bored.
Danger is boring.
Yeah, well, sometimes. Terrorism is. But, Yeah, Anicca dukkha, subject to change. Yeah, it's just like a sort of spectrum of ways that this word nibbida is sometimes used. Yeah, and in Thailand they usually translate it as bu anai, which basically means had enough of the world. Just sort of, yeah, it's like, oh God, that's a fifth again.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get much with danger. That danger would be the thing that provokes that.
Yeah, but danger is danger. Maybe drawback, or just danger is drawback. Yeah. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, when danger happens, danger threatens, you get excited or stimulated, not bored. Yeah.
Scared.
Yeah.
Being afraid.
Something like that. Yeah, it's basically seeing the drawbacks of something. You just lose. It's like a kind of aversion therapy. You know, so you're just seeing the negative side of things, the drawbacks of them.
I think it's kind of when you said danger there, it's a contrast to the gratification to show that it's both, that people don't want to see that there is going to take you.
Yeah. Yeah. Danger's maybe a bit specific. The drama of the world.
Life is a stage.
Life is a soap opera.
like sense through the eye, actually.
Yeah. My friend Stuart told me the story of one of his aunties who always used to follow every episode of one of these soap operas. I can't remember what it was, Days of Our Lives or something. And then they stayed for like 7 years in a country where they didn't have any TV. And then they came back and they picked up, they watched it again, and then they could pick up all the threads from when they were watching it before. And they became so, they became so nibida that they, that was it, they just...
Well, there's another problem.
There's another one that there was a fire in the warehouse where they stored all the the videos for Days of Our Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 years' worth got destroyed, but nobody knows.
That's a robust program. Fireproof. Logic-proof.
They actually cut that from... from viewing on the TV, and Natasha said that they got a lot of calls into Lifeline about it because people got really depressed that it was cut. People were so into it.
Crikey. Well, I was exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's terrible. Yeah. But anyway, I mean, nibbida is one of these words, you know, you can kind of discuss what the meaning and stuff is, but everyone, if you're in this class, you know what nibbida means.
Yeah.
Yeah? And we all know what it's like to just had enough. Yeah. If there was no escape, then there would not be beings, there would not be an escape. This one definitely means from the world, logamha. It's ablative. Beings do not escape from the world, but because there is an escape, therefore beings escape from the world. This is kind of interesting grammatically. Well, it's interesting for me, or I don't know if it's interesting for anyone else. There is an escape in the world, therefore beings escape from the world. Beings escape. Yeah. So yeah, so I might just skip a little bit, come on to page 159. These are the various cognates. One in this one, which is of course the and the collection, of course, is the Ajmagma. Thank you very much, Garner. Which is?
From which school?
From the Sarvasivadana school.
Yes.
Thanks. And the, of which the original. Of which the. I know, it's always the same. And of which the original language was. The original language was?
Sanskrit, or Buddhist has it Sanskrit?
Sanskrit.
Well, we've had three guesses so far. Does anyone actually Since there's only about four or five, thank you, got to just complete the set, yeah. It's got to be there somewhere. Any other guesses? Does anyone actually would like to have an actual? No, the original language. Probably Sanskrit. Magadhan. The Madhyama Agama, middle length discourses, known in Chinese as the Zhong Ahan Qing, Taisho 26, corresponding to the Madhyama Nikaya. A complete translation of the Madhyama Agama of the Sarvastivada school was done by Sanghadeva in the Eastern Jin Dynasty, 397 to 398 CE. So when they did the, they got a little note on the translation details. So this is actually one of our best sources for dating Indic texts is the Chinese translation dates. Madhyama Agama of the Sarvastivada school contains 222 sutras in contrast to the 152 sutras in the Pali Madhyama Nikaya. Portions of the Sarvastivada Madhyama Agama also survive in Tibetan translation. No, it doesn't say there, but it's Sanskrit. Yeah. Sarvastivada stuff is all in Sanskrit. And just to notice the dates here, and we've been looking at the Vinayas, and all the Vinayas, see these ones, Sanyukta is 435. Which one? Is in Sanskrit, yeah.
So how come some of them are Chinese?
No, there's all the original texts are in Sanskrit.
Yeah, so that means that only the original Sanskrit was kept
in the data? Yeah, it's just a random find that we happen to have come across. I mean, that was literally something that came out of the back of a sort of shonky camel dealer.
And is there a Chinese version?
No.
Of the Tibetan?
Not from the Sarvastivadins, no.
But
no? Okay, what happened was that when all of these got collected in China, it seems, more or less at random.
Mm-hmm.
So they were brought over at different times. So the Sanyukta Agama here doesn't say how it was brought over, but it was. I think it was brought. This one was brought over by Fa Xian from Sri Lanka to China, and here's the date to the translation, 435. So it would have been brought over a bit earlier. So it's just one. That's right. Yeah, and then this one, Madhyama Agama, came over a completely different way. I think this one was. Translated by somebody, it might have been even somebody who knew it. Some of the translations were done by monks who actually knew the thing off by heart, who came to China, and then they did the translation orally, in some cases, and in other cases it was the actual text. Most cases were the actual text. Dirga Agama from the Dharmaguptas, because that would have been brought over land through Central Asia. So they came over in completely different ways, but you can see that their dates are very similar, 397, 413, 397 to 398, and 435 to 443. So they're all translated basically within one generation, and the Vinayas were also all translated within one generation. So there's a few Agama Sutras which were translated before that, or again, kind of random things are brought over by different translators, and there's a few things afterwards, but the vast bulk of all the early Buddhist material was translated within one generation.
What I mean is that the Chinese, the Dīgā Agama Chinese, is also of the Dhammaputta.
That's right, yeah.
Why?
No reason. Yeah, it was just people coming back from overseas, and they happened to bring a text with them, and that's what they happen to have, so they translated it. Yeah. It's not. There's no. There's no thought that there was a particular method to that. I mean, there were a couple. There have been a couple of proposals as to why one rather than the other, but they're not really strong proposals. Basically, it seems like it's pretty much random. And there quite possibly would have been, or probably would have been, other translations, but they weren't. They sort of have disappeared. In fact, there's a few that are mentioned that have just disappeared. Right. Oh, okay. No, Mahayana sutras began to be translated in China from a very early period. Yes, before that, say 50 AD to 100 AD. So in fact the earliest evidence we have for Mahayana is from China. And there, for several hundred years, it seems as if the Mahayana tradition was very popular in China, while there's scarcely any evidence for it in India. In India, yeah. So that obviously it existed and they brought the texts over, but there's no... there's a lot of translations dated around 100 AD or something in China, but there's no... not major amounts of inscriptional evidence in India until maybe 500 AD or something. What does it mean? Kind of curious what it means. One thing it may mean, it's open for interpretation, but one thing it may mean is that there's a suggestion in recent scholarship on Mahayana that one of the driving forces behind the development of the Mahayana sutras was the invention of writing and the large-scale usage of writing. Yeah? And because you find within the Mahayana sutras they're constantly having these things about how you have to revere the texts. Yeah, you have to put the texts on the shrine, you have to worship them and all of these kinds of things. So if they were the innovators, and you can see that also relates to the nature of Mahayana literature as well, because you suddenly get all these kind of huge sutras, yeah, which are very kind of florid and so on. And so there's kind of this explosion of creativity. And so again, that kind of relate to the literary style. For the first time, it means that somebody can just sit down and compose something. Yeah, rather than having to work something up as an oral text, which takes a coordination among so many people and so many resources to actually put that together. So now suddenly, you know, it's what it seems to happen is that people will be sitting in meditation. You have a vision of the Buddha. The Buddha teaches all of these things to you, and you come out and say, fantastic, and you write it all down. Yeah. And so for the first time, you had that ability. But of course, once you've got the manuscripts, then it's relatively easy for a wandering tourist to bung one in his backpack and then hop on the ship to China. Yeah, so it's fairly easy for that tradition to actually move long distance very quickly, whereas when it's oral texts, then you'd need to have, you know, several people go and then teaching the people the language and everything like that, so it's much more transportable. So that all those things seem to be interlinked. But certainly what you can say is that once those teachings became known in China, they caught on very quickly. So Mahayana became mainstream in China long before it ever did in India. Yeah. Because they didn't have... Within the Indian tradition, because many Buddhists would have been familiar with the early Buddhists, you know, obviously most Buddhists in India, most of the time, would have all belonged to the early schools of Buddhism, even right up to the end of Buddhism. And so, of those, the learned among them would have had some familiarity with the Agama Sutras and the early Buddhist teachings, yeah? And so the Mahayana teachings sort of had to negotiate a place within that culture. And they weren't necessarily taken at that time as being literally the words of the Buddha, okay? At that time among those people. So some of them may have been, some of them may not have been, but some of them are clearly meant as satires. They're not meant as actual genuine historical records, yeah? And but when So it's a much more kind of nuanced context. But then when they were taken out and brought to China, of course they didn't have that whole context. Mm-hmm. So they just took everything as being the word of the Buddha. Yeah.
So where did they originally
arrive? Probably in many different places. It's difficult to locate a particular geographical spot for the origination of Mahayana. Some people think it was in the south of India, but it's really difficult to say. Yeah. I mean, remembering that it's all among, you know, communities of wandering mendicants, so it wouldn't have been, no need to think it would have been tied down to a particular location. But it's also the case that the Mahayana in India, certainly for many hundreds of years, would have been basically piggybacking on the early Buddhist traditions. So there would have been individual monks or nuns staying in the monasteries who would have been studying and practicing the Mahayana sutras, but not necessarily with separate orders and monasteries for Mahayana. Yeah, so it's more like a kind of a different take on the Dhamma rather than a completely different kind of Buddhism. Yeah.
So Gaurava Bodhidharma, which in Mahayana Buddhism, he was the one actually carrying oral teaching back to China.
Yeah.
It's actually different from, you know, what we are here.
Yeah, Bodhidharma. Yeah, what year was Bodhidharma? I'm not sure, I'm not that familiar with this. Bring Zen. What? Was he? Yeah, I think. Let's have a look. Okay, Bodhidharma, early 5th century CE, was the Buddhist monk traditionally credited as the transmitter of Zen to China. Very little contemporary biographical information on Bodhidharma is extant, and consequent accounts became layered with legend. But most accounts agree that he was a South Indian Pallava prince turned monk who journeyed to southern China and subsequently relocated northwards. The accounts differ as to his date of arrival, with one early account claiming he arrived in the Song dynasty. The same period, or maybe a little bit later, generation or two later. Then,
after Mahayana, when all the, you know, Theravada Sutta was translated, you know, it's about the time, isn't it? And that's
what. Yeah, at the time, maybe the time, but then of course, you know, that there's no. See, one of the things is to you know. Of course, ancient China was huge and complex, and there's no reason to think that, for example, the fact that Agama Sutras had been translated into Chinese had any impact on, say, Buddhism in the places he was teaching. Right? He may have been teaching in cities that knew nothing of the Agama Sutras. It might have been a completely different part of the country. So these are some things you have to sort of look at. There's no necessity that there's kind of influence there. Contemporaries, blah, blah, blah. Okay, from one of these, Bodhidharma was Persian Central Asian. Traveled from the wild borderlands to China, seeing the golden discs and the pole on the top of the light, illuminating the surface of the crowd, the jewels, and the echoes were already saying its praises. Truly, this is the work of spirits. I'm 150 years old and I've passed through numerous countries. There's version of the country I've not visited. Even in India, there's nothing comparable to the pure beauty of this monastery. Even the distant Buddha realms like this, he chanted homage.
I think supposedly, by the time he came to China, like the Buddhism at that time was like so much about arguing about the words of the Buddha, and they're just too much intellectual thinking, and that's why he introduced them to bring them into. It seems like already the basic sutras and the Mahayana sutras are already there, and that among people there's so much arguing about it instead of practicing.
The Dharma Master, Bodhidharma, another one, similar period. The Dharma Master was a South Indian of the Western region. He was the third son of a great Indian king of the Pallava dynasty. His ambition lay in the Mahayana path, so he put aside his white raiment's robe for the black robe of a monk. Cool.
And he was a Tamil.
South Indian of the Western Pallava region. But here he's saying he's the Western region is Persian. So Pallava, I think, is.
The Pallavas were. Yeah,
right. Mahabali Puru. That's Pallava. Pallava is, I think, isn't it? Tamil. Okay, so that's in there. I thought they knew Tamil kingdom. So, yeah, I mean, so obviously even in these very earliest comments you have this disparity, is he Southern Indian or is he Persian? South Indian of the Western region, the third son, blah, 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 Gaudiya king. Lamenting the decline of the true teaching in the outlands, he subsequently crossed distant mountains and seas, travelling about propagating the teaching in Han and Wei. So we don't have much contemporary information about him. 150 years old. Well, exactly, even in the earliest account, you've already got, it doesn't sound necessarily entirely journalistic, or maybe it is. In what kind of journalism? Yeah, of course.
The cutting off his eyelids and throwing it on the ground, and then the feet land on the ground, and then there's the one, what was it, the Shaolin hunchback scene that he got a special technique from India and got from the temple to some
kill.
Yeah. So it was 150
actually. So there's a lot of racing and things to come.
Okay, so come along to page 199, the cutting off of all affairs. Okay, so this is the Portalia Sutta, and the setting of this is that the wanderer Portalia comes and the Buddha addresses him as a layperson, and he's very upset because he claims to have cut off all his affairs. Okay, and he's basically kind of living a sort of semi-renunciate life while still staying at home. And the word they're translating as affairs here is vohara. Business, affairs, stuff. Okay, and so he claims to have cut off all his affairs, and the Buddha says, this is not what the cutting off of all affairs is in the Arya Vinaya. Yeah, the noble discipline. Okay, so Portalia asks him about that. So suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with mud. Sorry, with blood. Mud. Okay, so the Gogataka, the butcher's apprentice, notice that the word for apprentice here is antevasi. Same word that's used for a student of the teacher in the Sangha. What do you think? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, Venerable Sir. Why is that? Because it was just a collection of bones smeared with blood. Eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. Okay, so... Sorry? Doesn't know about dogs?
Maybe dogs love eating bones, and they get lots of nutrition out of them. Anyway.
They get lots of nutrition out of them?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously the Buddha didn't know about dogs, right? Or maybe the dogs in those days were better fed or something, I don't know.
Perhaps they were weak. jaws or something.
Speaking of corpses, when I was going back to my kuti today,
I saw
the corpse of a snake.
On the bench.
Did somebody?
No, it was near the sandstone pit, sandstone quarry, on the way up to my kuti. And then when I'm coming back, I see another dead snake on the bend down here.
Yeah, I saw that this morning.
I don't think I've ever seen a dead snake since
squashed?
I've been here. The heads, were, both of them, the heads were squashed.
Oh, no.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Like
that is seriously weird. Has anyone seen a snake with a squashed head before today in this monastery? Yeah? Not very often,
was huh?
On the road,
so it was in the, on the road. Oh, that was a car problem.
Did they find each other?
No.
No.
Did they have his squashing tools?
Cockabars.
It was the same kind, yeah. One of them, the one that was up near the quarry, was the same kind.
How big?
About that, I think.
Oh, could have been.
I don't know what kind it is, but it attacked me the other day. The one, the same one. I'm not saying anything about karma, okay? But it's just the fact that it did say it did attack me the other day.
It might want to attack you.
pretty much an attack in any kind of language that I know.
You were walking like a sheep.
It looked like a. Well, the one that was up near my kuti was it's kind of like monk's coloured with a dark grey head, which is quite a common one I've seen. The other one seemed to be quite black, almost black coloured. And both of them quite small. Did you see the one near the bend?
Yeah.
About 6 o'clock. And what was your one then?
It was olive, brown, and yellow underside.
Yeah, that was the same kind as one up there, yellow underside. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's the one, that's the most common one I've seen around here. That's very strange, isn't it? Yeah?
It reminds me of the one on the right. The car went
through
the cave last night.
Of course, yeah, it could have. But
the car went through the cave last night.
Well, it didn't come up past my kuti. It got past the quarry. There was a horse up there.
Where's
the quarry? Was that? The quarry. If you go up the road that leads to the far cave and to my kuti and stuff, up the steep part of the sect road there. There's a quarry on the left.
On the left of the cave, you go straight ahead.
Yeah. There's a few little quarries around the property. Yeah.
Before Daryl's caravan?
Before Daryl's caravan, yeah. Okay. Suppose. So too. A noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Having seen thus, as it is really is with proper wisdom, he avoids the equanimity that is diversified based on diversity, and develops the equanimity that is unified based on unity, where clinging to the carnal things of the world utterly ceases without remainder. What does that mean? Equanimity based on diversity?
Yes.
Ubekha, nanatta nanatta sitta. He dispels that and gets the equanimity based on unity.
This is because of turning the fast in there, isn't
it? They're fighting words there, Venerable.
Because you're meant to just watch the thoughts that arise in your mind and like in your bus insistence. So you just note them or you just be aware of them. Whereas this kind of meditation where you're just focused on one thing. So it's not diversified, it's the thoughts. And that's just sort of not being nice, but being
being real.
It doesn't mean what it means here, but I like to do provoke those kind of things.
Yeah. What any
diversified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily non-diversify, it says unified. So, what does that mean? The diversity which is...
It's been a fun way for me.
Can you read that sentence again, please? Just to check my cheat notes. As you know, is it 54?
Is that the end of the assistant? MN54.
Okay. So so read the sentence again. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. Sensual pleasures. A noble disciple, so we're talking about a stream enterer here, considers thus, at least a stream enterer, the sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is still more. Having seen this thus, as it really is with proper wisdom, okay, so seeing yathabhuta jnanadasana, or yathabhuta samapanyaya diswa, having seen as it really is, or in accordance with conditions, then that usually refers to the seeing of the Four Noble Truths at stream entry. Okay, then he avoids the equanimity that is diversified based on diversity, and develops the equanimity that is unified based on unity. Where clinging to the carnal things of the world utterly ceases without remainder. Okay, and again, this is ambiguity in the where. Okay, so you might think that, for example, if we were to say the equanimity which is unified refers to the fourth jhana, right, which is a pretty straightforward interpretation of that, then it might be taken as saying that the attachment to the world and so on ends in the fourth jhana, since this is a locative case. Okay, but we have the same ambiguity with the locative case that we had previously. It doesn't necessarily mean in a literal sense, but meaning with respect to or something like that. It's called a locative of reference. It's very common usage. So it could be translated as the unity, the equanimity that is unified, regarding which the clinging to the carnal things of the world utterly ceases without remainder.
What is equanimity that is diversified then?
Could that actually be in reference to the jhana and the other ones talking about the new provisions?
No. You wouldn't call jhanas, definitely wouldn't be called diversity, nanata.
What is it? So we can avoid it, please.
What is it so we can avoid it?
It is an equanimity though. Like, how can you have equanimity based upon the standing world?
Well, that's the question. Is that what it means?
Well,
if you
can have...
Definitely can't mean jhana.
If you can have right mindfulness, you can have wrong mindfulness. You have mm-hmm. right speech, you have wrong speech. So there must be right and wrong equanimity.
Right, right equanimity and wrong equanimity, yeah.
So perhaps... What's the lesson
difference? Indifference? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question.
But equanimity doesn't diversify. I mean, you know...
It's not
saying wrong equanimity or boring equanimity, or saying that it's diversified.
You can have a state of peace, like sort of going on a holiday, for example, and keeping back on the beach, there are all the columns taking the corners. Mm-hmm. That's the diversity of
sexual design. Man, do we have a beer or do we have a split? I mean, I don't care, not you. So, but what does it mean? What does it mean in the context, though?
Yes.
We've got a context of a passage here.
Yes.
Let's read the passage, not just the word.
Well, that's the first part's talking about sensual desire.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes us about as the background. Then you go on holiday, you think, oh, it's very nice. It's feeling very good. In Qantas light. Nothing troubles me now. The world was on the beach. Not thinking about work or whatever. You think it's equanimity, but it's equanimity based upon sensual desire, stimulus and such.
Yeah.
Contact point. But the other is not dependent on that contact.
As compared to the position before being on the beach, which was in a hard work situation, stressful or something or other. So we had one end of the spectrum compared to another end of the spectrum, which somewhat balances out. Somewhat balances out, but there is flux. So it is not continuous and persistent, which I see here as the equanimity of unity, which is persistent.
Could it just describe the progression in meditation? So when you first sit down, you have all this diversity and you remain at the moment so that you're actually heading towards the music.
Yeah.
Could you read the whole paper? There's one thing about it, I actually think it is a reminder. So it's almost like
it is, yeah. So the end of it is definitely talking about arahantship.
One alternative is to go from first through to fourth jhana. Because you have vitaka vichara, you have the mind at the beginning, the first jhana is disrupted by thinking or trying the mind to the object of meditation, moving towards an equanimity which is not diversified.
Yeah, but you never find jhanas are never described in terms of nanatta, diversity. Yeah, jhana is always defined in terms of.
Does it mean that the equanimity actually encompasses all kinds of sensual desire, like everything? So it comes towards any kind of equanimity, whereas people are diversified, it can be some sort of equanimity towards something, but not towards everything, every kind of thing.
Well, that was what I was looking at before. Have a look at the Chinese version. Have a look at that. Of course, according to the commentary, the diversity. The equanimity with diversity, based on diversity, is the equanimity regarding the five senses, and the equanimity based on unity is equanimity based on the fourth jhana. So I certainly think it's very reasonable to think about the fourth jhana in terms of this last one. Remember also the context. We've had a noble disciple, an Arya, realizing the four noble truths, seeing according to as it really is, so seeing the Four Noble Truths, and then this is, having done that, then what do they do? What does a noble disciple do after they become a stream enter or something like that? So then, for them to avoid, and also remember the context of the sutta, that we had this sort of lay ascetic character who believed he could live in the world with his family at his home, but avoiding any engagement with the world, And so the Buddha's saying, well, you're actually only half cut off because you're saying that you're not attached to it, but the stuff is all still there. So within that context, maybe saying, well, what you need to do at that stage is then go to a deeper development of the equanimity based on unity, which, as someone said, is not necessarily the equanimity based on diversity is not necessarily wrong. This is not what it's saying. It's saying that for somebody in that situation, that needs to be left behind, and the equanimity based on unity needs to be developed. But just to have a look here at, again, just to think in terms of Potalia and his situation, that he was like living at home. Our translation didn't give all of the thing, but he was basically living at home, but sort of acting as a wanderer or a monk, but still sort of living in
his meals, fortune, what
all those kind of things. Yeah. Exactly that. Exactly that. That you're actually you've got all the stuff, and you're living in the midst of it all. But you don't make any attempt to go any further. And he's saying, well, this is what cutting off of affairs means. Yeah, I've let go of everything, but you're not actually developing a deeper equanimity based on unity.
So having contentment with your current situation and thinking you're close with that.
Yeah.
Like, oh yes, I've got the car. I don't need a better car. I've got the house. I don't need a better house. My family's there. I get my food. It's okay. I'm close with that.
And again, not necessarily saying that that's wrong, but his illusion was that that was all that there was to the spiritual life. Nothing else needed to be done. Okay, so just to Venerable Nalio's discussion here, the two versions agree, this is the Pali and Chinese version, agree on concluding each simile with a description of how the noble disciple realizes the disadvantages of sensual pleasures and goes beyond them. The Pali version stands alone, however, in describing that the noble disciple avoids diversified equanimity and instead develops unified equanimity. Okay, so that's only found in the Pali version. According to the commentarial explanation, to develop unified equanimity refers to the equanimity of the fourth jhana. The attainment of the fourth jhana fits the Pratalya Sutta, since his discourse continues at this point with the three higher knowledges, whose development presupposes the development of the four jhanas. The same can also be seen in the Chinese version, which after the final simile explicitly mentions the development of the four jhanas. The Chinese account continues from the four jhanas directly to the destruction of the influxes without mentioning the first two higher knowledges included in the Pali account. So whether the phrase that we're discussing actually was part of the original text is open to doubt, since it's not in the Chinese version. Sorry? Which one? It's a slightly unusual phrasing. There probably are similar phrases in other places. I can't recall it right away, but yeah, it is a bit of an unusual phrasing. Okay, so next, and then so a whole series of similes that the Buddha gives here on the dangers of sensual pleasures. A vulture, heron or hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away, and then other vultures, herons and hawks pursued it and pecked it and clawed it. What do you think? If that first vulture, heron or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it thereby incur death or deadly suffering? One of the aspects of sensual pleasures, which is very having possessions, which is people often don't think about, you know, is just the anybody who has them immediately is surrounded by the kind of jealousy and attacks and things like that. So then various other similes. I won't go through all of the similes, but here's another one. Suppose a man dreamed about lovely parks, groves, meadows and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of them. So too, a noble disciple considers thus sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. And another one, householder. Suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage and fine jewel earrings, and preceded and surrounded by those borrowed goods he went to the marketplace. And people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for the man to become dejected? So things haven't changed all that much, have they, really?
Yeah,
I mean, these days.
Now,
eh? Yeah, everyone's got all their Porsches and stuff on the...
We've got friends that have lost their BMW 5 and their Mercedes.
Yeah, they're rich men.
They didn't own the cars.
Yeah. Yeah.
This seems like a dialogue which is going on now, but the previous statement about diversification seems a bit out of place.
About the what, sir?
Diversification and unification.
Uh-huh.
It was like we're going from talking about super mundane states to talking about jewellery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's only a simile. It's just an illustration.
But it seems out of place, I think, in the narrative. It's like it's talking about sensual pleasures, maybe we jump to super mundane thing, and then we're going back to cars and jewellery and hawks eating flesh and stuff like this. It seems to be a little bit like somebody's done a cut and paste, like, get that in there, make it sound pretty impressive, keep going.
Maybe.
It's a bit strange. It's a bit of a Harley version.
Yeah.
This is the only scripture I've mentioned in the, that I've come across.
Yeah.
Actually has this simile.
That particular simile? Yeah, it's a unique simile, I think, yeah.
The whole thing about the skeleton and the...
Some of them are found elsewhere.
The dog and bone ones.
Yeah, some of them are found elsewhere, yeah. Suppose...
the bloody bone.
Okay, so the next one. Suppose a dense grove not far from some village or town had a tree laden with fruit. And then a man came seeking fruit and he entered the grove. He saw the tree and he thought, well, I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want and fill my bag. And that's what he did. Then a second man came along, also seeking fruit. And taking a sharp axe, he entered the grove and saw that tree laden with fruit. He thought, there's a tree laden with fruit. I don't know how to climb a tree, so why don't I cut this tree down at the root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag? And he did so. The first man who climbed down the tree didn't come down quickly. When the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or foot or something other part of his body? So he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that. So, one to watch out for.
The first one is a labour vote, and the second one is a liver vote. A whole tree.
So, yeah. So, with the reading or the interpretation of the equanimity thing. If you have a look at the text here, we've now gone from the passage about the simile of the fruit tree, and then having seen that one avoids the equanimity based on diversity and develops the equanimity based on unity, and then the very next passage, very next paragraph, it says, then that noble disciple, iman yeva anuttarang upekha sati parisuddhin, agama, having arrived or dependent on that very same unexcelled purity of equanimity and mindfulness, he goes on to develop the many kinds of recollection of past lives. Okay, so here the unexcelled upekha sati parisuddhin is obviously referring to the fourth jhana, and that phrase, the purification of mindfulness through equanimity, or however you want to translate that, always refers to the fourth jhana. And so it says imanyeva, this very same yeva. So that's clearly saying that this phrase here was referring to the fourth jhana, equanimity based on unity.
That paragraph 101 or 49,
yeah.
Is that in here?
No, I don't
think it is.
Yeah, he's only abbreviated version here. Mm. So then based on that, then develops the recollection of past lives, the divine eye, and seeing the ending of defilements. Okay. And then he goes on to ask the Potalia whether he sees this as being the true cutting off of all affairs, and Potalia replies, what I thought before was the cutting off of all affairs was nothing compared to this. So then he took refuge in the triple gem.
I'm just oddly surprised if he understood at that point of time what Upeka meant, with the explanation he's given. Not the similes, but the other terminology.
Yeah.
Like what's an irony to somebody who doesn't know about that the point of truth is that Upeka explains himself to such a person.
Well, that's the problem you have all through the suttas, is that the it sort of assumes a familiarity with basic terminology and so on.
Mm. What was his background?
Yeah, he was a wanderer of some kind. Mm.
But the arahant also, it was not just a Buddhist word. It was a word which was like what we would call in the society a saint or something like that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be a Christian saint. If you say saint, you think that someone is very holy and has done good for humanity or something like that.
Yeah. So yeah, it's always difficult because the words would have been, many of the terms would have been understood, but not necessarily understood in the same sense.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, also remember it's an edited text, it's not a literal representation of the discussion. Okay, so, but the idea, anyway, leaving aside those technical discussions, but the idea and the sort of repeated similes are very memorable examples of the Buddha's attitude towards sensual pleasures. And now some of the themes that we've been discussing are brought up and brought together in the next little sutta, which has some of my favourite similes, Margandhya Sutta, Majjhima 75.
It's raised again, isn't it, with like a burning pit full of hot embers and things like this?
That was in there, I didn't read that one. Okay. Margandhya, formerly, when I lived the household life, I enjoyed I enjoyed myself provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure. Okay, so this particular idiom which Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as the five cords of sensual pleasure, kama guna, that's based on a particular gloss of this word guna, which is found in the Pali commentaries, but which is evidently not known anywhere in the northern traditions. So it's probably not a particularly good rendering. It's probably just the five kinds of sensual pleasures is better. Forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tactile objects cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. So here's the kind of standard passage on those things. The various sense objects which are itta, okay, ganta, manapa, Iyarupa, delightful form. Kamupasanghita, connected with desire. Radhaniya, provocative. I had three palaces, one for the rainy season, one for the winter, and one for the summer. I lived in the rain's palace for the 4 months of the rainy season, enjoying myself with musicians. None of them were male, and I did not go down to the lower palace. Okay. So the this being the kind of the kernel of the later legends of the Buddha's life before he ordained, and the stories of the dancing girls and so on. On later occasion, having understood, as they really are, the origin, the passing away, the gratification, the danger and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures, I abandoned craving for sensual pleasures, I remove the fever, and I dwell without thirst with a mind inwardly at peace.
Okay, so this is the fourth one. Sometimes the three gratification, danger and escape.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it also has the other one, which is the origin.
Uh-huh, yeah, the origin, they're passing away, yeah? This is five, a set of five. Origin, passing away, gratification, danger and escape. Yeah. So it's either in three, gratification, danger and escape, or a set of five, the origin, passing away, gratification, danger and escape. Okay, I see, when I see other people who are still not free from lust for sensual pleasures, indulging in them, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because there is, Magandhi, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight in that. So it's a very important statement here. So the Buddha's not sort of having a go at pleasure as such. Right? He's not saying that it's wrong to be happy or it's wrong to have pleasure. He's saying, well, there are inferior and superior kinds of pleasure, so we don't have to have be jealous of those enjoying those inferior kinds of pleasure. And there is another yayam anyatra kamehi, anyatra akusalehi damehi. Okay, and so you should be familiar with this phrase. It's very similar to the phrase which begins the formula of the first jhana. Okay, which is even higher than divine bliss. Okay. So then, a bit further down, one of the most memorable similes in the Pali Canon. Suppose Magandhya, page 204, suppose Magandhya there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then he might see another leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man envy that leper for his burning charcoal pit or his use of medicines? No, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because when there is sickness, there is need for medicine, and when there is no sickness, there is no need for medicine. So, the Buddha's attitude towards sensual pleasures. Interesting whether it actually is leprosy they're talking about, because there's usually no cure for leprosy. It certainly wasn't until recently. I think they recently found a cure.
Thinking of raising that as an issue, but I decided not to.
Mm. Is that right?
Yeah, no, there had been no cure for leprosy until fairly recently.
Yeah.
But it's an aspirational thing. That's why I said nothing about it.
Mm.
That's what I thought.
It's an aspirational thing?
Yeah, it was aspired to.
Aspired to find a cure.
Oh, the cure. Yeah. Oh.
In those days, it was aspired to. It was a good thing to come up with an idea.
Yeah.
As a cure for leprosy, which is, albeit nowhere near as dreadful as it's made out to be.
Mm.
I mean, it's a bit crook, but it's not that terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's... I guess there's either two possibilities here. One is that there used to be a cure which was lost, which is quite possible, or else it was a different disease, is actually what they're talking about. Anyway.
What does it indicate that it's cured?
Does it in the same?
Get medicine.
So you got medicine?
Get medicine. Someone makes medicine for him. I mean, what other kind of diseases, skin diseases, do you get where maggots eat out of your
gangrene? Yeah, possibly. I don't know. But also diseases change over time quite a lot. So,
leprosy has been around for a long time,
And
it's been a sort of scourge of humanity. And lepers in many cultures have been looked upon as outcasts.
Mm.
So there's that double barrel sort of thing as well.
Social thing, yeah.
I hear the story of mystic nun makes to kiss and leave the
room.
Mm. That's not virtue. You can do that.
Mm.
Because getting over the anger early is the only way to do that. Like if you were to say, bite the head of a snake, it's a bit of a...
I was walking a video one day.
No, it's not that contagious.
So it's almost completely non-contagious.
Yeah.
In fact.
And it takes a long time to develop.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Okay. Later on, the Buddha then extends the use of the simile. He says, "What do you think?" Uh, asking a question about the nature of perception regarding that. Yeah? So he said, for when that leper was treating his sores, yeah, although the fire that he was cauterizing his sores with was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. Yeah? So this is quite interesting.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, James, but I've got leprosy. I think it's quite an interesting simile, because leprosy, isn't it, deaden the nerves, or so you actually lose perception in your limbs, and that's why you get the sores, because whenever you injure yourself, you actually can't feel it, and they become infected. And
that may be correct.
That's how I
But their leprosy is an infectious disease.
Oh, it is, it is. But that's how I thought it actually affected them.
I'm not sure.
I think that's correct.
Mm.
It's transmitted by long term exposure to usually as a child. Yeah.
So it's like, you need to drink a bucket of saliva or something to get it.
Something like that, yeah.
But you lose feeling.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, that's the point. You lose the feeling. You lose the feeling before you get
injured,
the wound.
Yeah, and injured, and you know, if you get an injury and an infection, and so not a person being well cared for and looked after, and somebody notices they've got wounds.
Doesn't necessarily
get the sores.
When they get cured, do they recover the feeling?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure.
I don't know, but in our current situation in the world of now, this is experienced by an increasing number of people because of diabetic conditions.
Yes.
Diabetes and increased blood sugar levels cause a neuropathy, an inability of the nerves to transmit feelings from A to B or whatever, and diabetics burn themselves, kick their feet, and then they get gangrenous wounds.
Yeah.
Together with the reduced blood flow to the areas, which is one of the real great hazards of untreated diabetes.
Yeah.
I would put it as an unpleasantness greater than leprosy.
Yeah, one wonders whether you wonder whether the description here sounds more like gangrene than like leprosy.
Mm-hmm. I still take the position it's setting up a mind picture.
Yeah.
Of you know, it doesn't have to be leprosy.
Yeah,
I mean, leprosy is just a word to denote a state.
Of
something.
Yeah.
And if we don't look too far into the
medical disease.
Exact meaning of it, then we're likely to get the exact meaning.
Yep. So, at the end, then. Shall we do the medical research?
Later.
Yeah, maybe later. So the point here, so too, people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, the more they indulge in them, the more their craving increases and the more they're burned by the fever, yet they find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment independent on the five cords of sensual pleasure. So just like the leper cauterizing his wounds, they find a certain degree of enjoyment. Yeah, distorted perception, exactly, yeah. That's right.
So you're born with distorted perception
already. Yeah. So he's talking about the way that you're actually getting burnt and feverish. You know, it's actually creating agitated and disturbed states of mind, but you're perceiving it as pleasant.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, so another one, this is another one of my favourite sort of mine with a lot of great similes, page 206. Long ago, O monks, there lived a religious leader named Araka, who was free of sensual desire. So when it says, talks of this kind of idiom, a non-Buddhist rishi or sage of some kind, and it says free of sensual desire, usually means that they were a jhana practitioner.
Did you say jhana or
jhana? And here it says Ahosi, it says Dittakaro. Dittakaro is the word that the Jains use, interestingly enough. Kamesu Vitaraka. Anyway, so obviously a respected teacher of the past, sectarian leader who is free of passion for sensual pleasures. He had many hundreds of disciples, and this was the doctrine he taught them. Short is the life of human beings, O Brahmins, limited and brief. It is full of suffering, full of tribulation. This one should wisely understand. One should do good and live a pure life, for none who is born can escape death. Just as the dewdrop on the tip of a blade of grass will quickly vanish at sunrise and will not last long, even so, Brahmins, is human life like a dewdrop. Just as when rain falls from the sky in thick drops, a bubble appearing on the water will quickly vanish and will not last long, so human life is like a water bubble. Just as a line drawn on water with a stick will quickly vanish and will not last long, human life is like a line drawn on water. Just as a river flowing down the mountains, going far, its current swiftly flowing, carrying along much flotsam, so it will not stand still for a moment, an instant, a second, but will rush on, swirl and flow forward. Even so, Brahmins, is human life like a mountain stream. Just as a strong man might form a lump of spittle at the tip of his tongue and spit it out with ease, unless he's in Singapore, of course, then even so, Brahmins, is human life like a lump of spittle. Just as a piece of meat thrown onto an iron pan, heated all day, will quickly burn up and will not last long. Just as when a cow to be slaughtered is led to the shambles whenever she lifts a leg, she will be closer to slaughter, closer to death. Even so is human life like cattle doomed to slaughter. It is full of suffering, full of tribulation. But at that time, Marx, so here comes the twist in the plot. So in those days, in the time of Araka, the human life was 60,000 years. Yeah. Girls were marriageable at 500.
Yeah.
In those days, people had only six afflictions: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. So they didn't have the diseases and things that we have. Though people lived so long and had so few afflictions, still that teacher Araka gave to his disciples such a teaching.
So that's the teachings of Araka.
Araka, yeah, the teaching of the short.
Urine is an affliction, even though it's used as a medicine.
Yeah.
It's part of his teaching, isn't it? So it says, lays out here.
Yeah, it's listed as well. Yeah, it's just an affliction in the sense of being something kind of unpleasant you have to do with your body. Yeah.
I think you're in a concert or orchestral performance. You need to go to the toilet. There's 500,000 people in Europe.
Okay,
so
now we just live, someone who lives long lives for 100 years or a little more. And it's kind of an interesting point, but it's often said, or it seems to be commonly held belief, that humans in past times lived for only 30 or 40 years. But in the suttas it always says that people lived for the full lifespan was 100 years. It doesn't necessarily mean the average lifespan, but like the full lifespan of someone who lived to a ripe old age would be considered to be 100 years. That's just 300 seasons, 100 winters, 100 summers and 100 rains. For 300 seasons it's just 1200 months. For living for 1,200 months, it's just 2,400 fortnights. when living for 2,400 fortnights, it's just for 36,000 days, 12,000 days in winter, 12,000 in summer, and 12,000 of the rains. When living for 36,000 days, you just get to eat 72,000 meals. And this includes the taking of mother's milk and the times without food, such as when you're agitated or grieved or sick, fasting or not getting anything to eat. Thus, O monks, I've reckoned the life of a centenarian. Centenarian? The limit of his lifespan and so on. Whatever should be done by a compassionate teacher who out of compassion seeks the welfare of his disciples, that I have done for you. These are roots of trees, O monks, these are empty huts. Do jhanas, monks, do not be negligent, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. Well, someone who has either vipassana or jhanas is doing pretty good.
It's a rhythm.
So, it's a good sutta, isn't it?
What is it?
It's in the Anguttara Nikaya.
Lots of good numbers.
That one about the cow being led to the slaughter is every step of the way.
I'm interested in the word led to the shambles, which is a.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Very one? Current teaching. So the next one goes on to a discussion of part of the Ratpala Sutta. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go through all of it now. But the end of that, the four summaries of the Dhamma, is a very beautiful teaching. Ratapala, of course, is the famous story of the fellow who wanted to go forth so much that he lay down on the ground and threatened to starve to death. And here's all the various corresponding suttas. As you can see, a huge amount of them. Must be one of the biggest amounts of correspondence, certainly in any Majjhima suttas. Obviously attesting to the popularity of the story. These ones are various Agama sutras. These ones are in kinds of Buddha biography, legendary collections and so on. And these guys are in those Sanskrit fragments. And also two in Tibetan.
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinary.
It is.
So very widely spread, very popular sutta. So you've had this, it's a kind of interesting structure, because you've had this whole story of Ratapala and his conflict with his parents and everything, and which is basically the only bit that everybody knows. So if you talk about Ratapala to Buddhists, then they'll know the story of how he went forth and so on. It's a very popular story, but there's almost never any attention given to the actual teachings that Ratapala gave. It's a bit like the story of Jesus, you know, everyone knows that he got crucified and stuff, but nobody actually knows what he was talking about. So, but he essentially, after he became an arahant, and he went off and he was staying by himself in a park, and the king, Kauravya, who's the king of, I'm not sure where he's coming off, came to see him and said, that most people go forth because they either get old or they get sick or they lose all their relatives or have some disaster and that's why they go forth. But here you are, you're still young, you've got your family, wealth and so on, and you've gone forth. Why is it that that's happened? And the Ratapala's answer was, great king, there are four summaries of the Dhamma which have been taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened. Okay, so the Chataro Dhammudesa. So four summaries of the Dhamma. Of course, interestingly enough, he's referring these teachings back to the Buddha, but they don't occur anywhere else in this same phrasing, certainly in the Pali canon, as far as I'm aware. So the four things, and they're quite beautiful little phrases, encapsulations of the Dhamma. First one, that the world is unstable, it is swept away. Upaniyati loko anduvo. The second one, the world has no shelter and no protector. Dano loko anabhisaro. Third one, the world has nothing of its own, one has to leave all and pass on. Asako loko sabang pahaya gamaniyam. Asako, there's nothing one owns. One doesn't own anything in the world. You have to leave everything behind and go on. Uno loko atito tanha daso. The world is deficient, inadequate, or insatiate. The insatiate, slave of craving. It's always lacking. The world's always lacking something, wanting something more.
You know, there's the definition when they talk about the world.
Yeah.
So the world is lacking sufficient craving.
Yeah.
So people are lacking sufficient craving.
Yeah. Yeah. Vicca Bodhi's translated as life in the world, or life in any world is lacking and so on. So, but you know,
when actually life, thinking about the world in a certain way.
When it talks about the world, it's always, from a Buddhist point of view, it's always meaning like the inner perception of the world, or how you see the world, so your own experience of the world. Yeah. So the world is the six senses is the world. So I really love these four phrases. Sorry, Annie?
Just trying to make sense of it. When it says life in the world is unstable, it's swept away, does it refer to being the impermanence of everything?
That's, yeah, due to your impermanence.
And in any world has no shelter and no protector, I'm not quite sure.
Like Jesus Christ, there's no...
There's no, like, deity or somebody to rescue you. It's all up to yourself.
That would be one reading of it, yeah, one interpretation of it, yeah.
And
security.
That,
it's a good one for sixes to come and
carry. What is it?
The security.
And so what?
Real.
So real? Yeah. Just really cuts to the heart of it, yeah.
As a child, you know, it's the first thing you do, you can't tell it. You know, you have to pitch to your mum to go to catch something. You have to rely on something.
The baby's very vulnerable.
So then Ratapala goes on to, the king asks him what's the meaning of these things, and he says, okay, what's the meaning of the first one? Life, the world is unstable and swept away. And he says, when you were young, So I'll just summarise these a bit quickly. It says, when you were young, were you not an expert rider of elephants, an expert warrior and archer, sturdy and capable in battle? The king says, I certainly was, Master Ratapala. Sometimes I wonder if I had supernormal power then. I do not see anyone who could equal me in strength. What do you think? Are you now as strong as you were then? He says, Ratapala, I'm old, advanced in life. Sometimes I mean to put my foot here and I put my foot somewhere else. So this is what that means.
Just check it out. You watch it.
Okay, the world has no shelter and no protector, is this one. He said, the king says, well, I've got all my elephant troops and cavalry that will keep us safe and subdue any threats to us, but you say we don't have any shelter or protector. And the Ratapala says, king, do you have any chronic ailment? He says, well, yeah, I have a chronic wind ailment. Sometimes my friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, stand around me thinking, now the king's going to die, now he's going to die. Yeah? And what do you think, king? Can you command your friends and say, all of you present, share this painful feeling so that I may feel less pain? Or do you have to feel that pain yourself alone? And he said, I cannot command my friends and kinsmen to feel that pain for me. I have to feel it alone. And this is the world has no protector and no shelter. The next one, Ratapala, there are in this court abundant gold coins and bullion stored away in vaults and lofts. But Ratapala says, the world has nothing of its own, one has to leave all and pass on. What does this mean? What do you think? You now enjoy yourself provided and endowed with the five chords of sensual pleasure, but can you be certain that in the life to come you will enjoy yourself similarly, or will others take over your property while you pass on according to your karma? So this is what that means. One has to leave all and pass on. The last one, Ratapala said that the world is incomplete, is deficient, insatiate, the slave of craving. So what do you think, great king? Do you reign over the rich Kuru country? Oh, well, there you go, that's where he is. He's in the Kuru country. We didn't have the original, which is the region of Delhi, modern Delhi. Mm. What do you think, great king? Suppose a trustworthy and reliable man came to you from the east and said, please know, great king, that I come from the east, and there I saw a large country, powerful and rich, very populous and crowded with people. There are plenty of elephant troops there, cavalry and so on, lots of ivory, gold, bullion. So plenty of gold coins and bullion, both worked and unworked, and plenty of women for wives. With your present forces, you can conquer it. Conquer it then, great king. What would you do? He said, well, we'd conquer it and reign over it. What if someone came from the west, from the north, from the south, or even from over the sea and said the same thing? He said, we would conquer it and reign over it. This is what we meant when we said that the world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving.
Life is just the we.
Oh, that was just my bit there. Oh. Oh, no, sorry, he uses the we, yeah, the royal we. Yeah. Where did it come from? So, yeah, he does use the royal we. So. Okay, so let's read one or two more before we finish for today. But here's one on the blind men and the elephant. At that time, a number of ascetics and Brahmins, wanderers of other sects, were living around Savatthi. This is page 214. They held various views, beliefs and opinions and propagated various views. They were quarrelsome, disputatious, wrangling, wounding each other with verbal darts, saying, the Dhamma is like this, the Dhamma is not like that, the Dhamma is not like this, the Dhamma is like that. And some of the monks told the Buddha about this, and the Buddha said, monks, he said, the wanderers of other sects are blind and sightless. They do not know what is beneficial and harmful. They do not know what is Dhamma and what is not Dhamma, and that's why they're so quarrelsome and disputatious. If formerly monks, there was a king in Savatthi who addressed a man and asked him to round up all the persons in the city who were blind from birth. When the man had done so, the king asked the man to show the blind man an elephant. To some of the blind men he presented the head, some the ear, some the tusk, some the trunk, some the body, the foot, the hindquarters, the tail, or the tuft at the end of the tail. And to each one he said, "This is an elephant." When he reported to the king what he had done, the king went to the blind men and asked them, "Tell me, blind men, what is an elephant like?" Those who had been shown the head of the elephant replied, "An elephant, your majesty, is just like a water jar." Those who had been shown the ear said, "An elephant is just like a winnowing basket." Those who had been shown the tusk said, "An elephant is just like a plowshare." Those who had been shown the trunk said, "An elephant is just like a plow pole." Those who had been shown the body replied, "An elephant is just like a storeroom." And each of the others likewise described the elephant in terms of the part they had been shown. And then saying, "An elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that, an elephant is not like this, an elephant is like that," they fought each other with their fists. And this is a bit I love about this. It says, "And the king was delighted." So the king says he's evidently used this as a form of afternoon's entertainment. Let's trick all the blind men and get them to fight each other. Even so, monks, the wanderers of other sects are blind and sightless. That's why they're quarrelsome, disputatious, and wrangling, wounding each other with verbal darts. Okay, so here on the classic simile, often used by Ajahn Brahm and many others, and a very vivid one. And of course, the point of it being that each one of them, in a sense, has a proper perception. They are actually seeing a genuine part of the elephant, and so very often we latch onto part of the truth, which actually is genuine, it is part of the truth, and then we take that to be the whole truth. This is why we end up arguing with people. That's a very, very wise. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the Buddha said anyone who has vipassana is good. So we shouldn't criticize those who have those things which maybe we don't have ourselves also. So, okay.
This text is also not just the Buddhist one. I think they use it in other. And somewhere else I'm reading about that particular symbol.
Yeah.
And that it's used in other religious contexts as well.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question related to this before?
Yeah, of course.
About the idea of the perspective in Buddhism?
Yeah.
So I had a question with one of my colleagues who has done a lot of Buddhist practice, but now she's turning back towards Christianity because she feels that Buddhism is very lonely, like you're doing it on your own. And I was quite surprised by that because what I said to her was that I hadn't thought about it that way because of the taking refuge in the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha. And I thought that, well, the being on your own part, that's the Dhamma in the sense that you're encouraged to not to take things with faith and to find out for yourself and, you know, you have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
But that the other aspects of taking refuge in the Buddha and taking refuge in the Sangha seem to, well, one way of putting it would be that it provides kind of protection.
Yeah.
But is this, I mean, it's interesting that this is such a thing to emphasize that idea that there is no protector.
Yeah.
So you have to make an island to oneself.
Yeah, but I think also it's like the world is not, is, you know, in the world there's no protector. And you know, it was talking about and that was the context it was talking about, you know, seeing that you know, your security forces in that case were going to be providing a sense of false protection. So I guess in a sense that that the Triple Gem is a shelter, and also seen as a shelter and a refuge, and Nibbana is seen as a shelter and a refuge. Although it is so in a necessarily kind of limited way, right? So you can't pray to the Triple Gem and make them take your cancer away or something like that. Yeah? And that's just also, in a sense, acknowledging the reality of the world.
But what about devotional practices in Buddhism?
Yeah.
I mean, they seem to have a very similar, function that they're doing in Christianity, but there is a sense that you don't have to do everything on your own.
Absolutely.
You know, and also, what I said was also the teaching on self means that you're connected, and you kind of understand those connections, so they can operate in ways that are beyond your, you know, conscious control.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and I think that definitely there's a strong strand in Buddhism that there is that sense of connection, both in terms of a spiritual sense of connection, as a feeling connection through the Dhamma and so on, and also in a sense of the community and all of those things. So those things I think are very true.
Mm.
And I think there is a strand of Buddhism where it says, you know, that somebody eko upakato alone, withdrawn, ardent, they go off to meditate by themselves. So that's, there is a part of Buddhist practice where you are alone, and you know, so that's acknowledging part of the truth of the world, but that's only a partial truth. I mean, I don't know that particular context, but I'm wondering whether how much that's conditioned, because I think in the way that Buddhism's been presented in the West, it's transmitted in quite an individual way, like say through reading books, for example, or through seeing something on the web, or these are solitary activities, whereas traditionally it's transmitted through, like what we're doing, through coming together as a community.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder whether that's had an impact on that perception of being Buddhism being like that.
Did your friend have a personal, I mean, this was how, what was her practice like? Was it with a group?
Well, yeah, I think she has practiced with groups. I don't know her very well, I've met her twice. But often, I mean, my own experience with Dharma groups in the city is that they can be very cold. For some reason, Buddhism in the West often attracts people who are quite independent and not necessarily wanting a close sort of community in the city context. Or maybe have difficulty with that. That's why they're rejecting Christianity partly.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, who's that? I think I'd been to Dharma Loka Buddhist Centre about once or twice, and it's fairly daunting, but and somebody said to me, somebody else, I met outside somebody who went there regularly, and I was really pleased to meet somebody else who went there, because I didn't know anybody at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, and at one stage she said to me, people don't feel a need to, people don't socialise. She sort of like said, I got this impression, well, this is a Buddhist thing, you don't have personal connections and you don't, sort of do the normal social detached stuff that other groups of people do. And I thought it was a bit strange. Then I did meet other people who weren't quite
quite that hardcore. Well, that's why they introduced, precisely for that reason, the after the talk cup of tea.
Yeah.
You know, in the first years when they had that, they didn't do that. They just came, they had a Dhamma talk, and then they finished the talk and everyone went home.
Mm.
And so they didn't develop a sense of connection. So then they said, this isn't working. So then they said, oh, we'll have a cup of tea and cookies after the Dhamma talk. And so then that's now turned into this kind of rampant chat fest.
It is. But for an outsider, it's still very daunting.
Yeah. In a sense, it's also, I mean, I've noticed that also in Woolwich, that you in one way, you know, you try to create a kind of a warm feeling with the people who are there, but also even that then becomes a bit daunting for people who come from outside, because they're not part of the group. Yeah, so it's an interesting kind of... interesting balance.
It's good that you have the middle of the village. You're supposed to have up to the end of the
place
first.
We fit in the middle.
Yeah. And then a few people sometimes, you know, stay for more discussion afterwards. So but it is important, and it's something that we need to, you know, that's why, for example, I was talking for a while, I had this kind of idea of doing a Buddhist kind of cricket match or something like that, you know.
Sri Lankans versus
Sri Lankans versus the Aussies, yeah.
Or versus the rest.
Buddhist cricket match, did I hear that clearly?
Yeah, you heard that correctly, yeah. It would be just, Buddhist cricket match would be just like a 7-day Vipassana retreat, except there's less happening.
Does that mean that there's so more active than an ordinary cricket match?
Yeah. Okay, so we're approaching the end here. So there's some beautiful verses there at the end, which Bhikkhu Bodhi hasn't translated. If you have a look in the Majjhima Nikaya, but Ratapala gives some very beautiful verses there. So, I've already gone to the blind end, but I just saw these on here. It reminded me. So do yourself a favour, as Molly used to say. Okay, I won't read any more suttas here, but. Just later on, it talks and gives some of the classic similes on the undiscoverability of samsara, of the first point of samsara, and the simile of the stream of tears and so on. So there's some very powerful similes there. Okay.